Listen up. I hate to have commercials interrupt this interview, so I'm going to tell you about three sponsors quickly now, and then we're going to go right into the program, starting with Walker Corporate Law. If you need a lawyer who understands the startup world and the tech community, I want you to go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Next, I want to tell you about Shopify. When your friend asks you, "How can I sell something online?" I want you to send them to Shopify and explain to them that Shopify stores are easy to set up. They increase sales and they'll make your friends' products look great. Shopify. Finally, I want to tell you about Grasshopper. Do you want a phone number that people can call and then press one for sales, two for tech support, etc., and have all of the calls be routed to the right person's cell phone? Well, get your number from grasshopper.com. All right, let's get started.
Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart and home of the infinite tech trouble, it seems like. Today's guest was good enough after we had some tech trouble last week to come back, and now we're doing this interview not on Skype, but on GoToMeeting. Thank God for backup systems and backups to backup systems because it felt like everything failed recently. In this interview, I want to find out how an idea that happened to an entrepreneur on an overseas trip became a business that was sold to Home Depot. In 2008, Ethan Anderson launched RedBeacon, which allowed you to compare prices, ratings, and appointment availability for home service providers. About 3 years later, he sold it. Today, he's building MyTime, which lets you book appointments with thousands of local businesses like housekeepers and dentists. And they just recently launched MyTime Favorites, which will allow you to book appointments with companies that haven't even signed up for MyTime. And that way, you get the convenience of booking with them online. Ethan, thanks for doing this interview.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to be here.
So, a lot of difficulty in running a business. Frankly, you can see even my little operation here is having a lot of tech trouble. You had a lot of challenges building it up. You finally sold. What's the payoff? Do you remember the day of sell that you sold it? Did it feel as great as I imagine?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously incredibly exciting. And when you feel like you found a great home for the company that you've worked so hard to build and one that makes a lot of sense, that feels really wonderful. For me, it's kind of an age of talent acquisitions, I feel like, where no one fails anymore. Everyone just gets acqui-hired. But usually what happens when you get acqui-hired is your company disappears. Your users are left in the lurch, and the years of hard work that you put into it were really for nothing other than proving yourself as a hard worker. And so I was really thrilled that Home Depot, is probably the best home, no pun intended, for Red Beacon that I could even imagine. What they've done with the store integrations, what they've done with leveraging their own service professionals who shop at Home Depot and customers who shop at Home Depot, and making Red Beacon a part of that shopping experience is something I could never have even imagined, the day I came up with Red Beacon.
And the idea that you sold a company and you can point to Home Depot and say, there, it's now part of that big organization. And everyone, your mother, my mother, everybody knows what Home Depot is.
Right, of course. And like I love that, you can walk into the store and see signage and kiosks and the store associates will talk to you about it. It's even kind of fun that they painted the Home Depot NASCAR with the Red Beacon colors and the Red Beacon logos for a
Oh,
while.
wow.
Pretty cool.
So then, what's the difference between Red Beacon and MyTime? I was trying to describe them in the intro, and I looked at it and said, anyone who listened to that would say, Andrew usually does his research, but I can't tell the difference between these two introductions. So what is the difference
Sure.
between MyTime and Red Beacon?
Okay, well, let me start with what Red Beacon is, and then I'll move into what the current startup I'm working on, MyTime, is. So Red Beacon was about getting bids or price quotes for home service jobs specifically. When you need to have a complex job done in your house, they're almost never a fixed price, and every business that you call will quote you very different prices and has very different qualifications. They usually need to even come on site to make a final determination. So what Red Beacon would do is it would simplify that process for you. You would get four or five bids from plumbers, electricians, roofers, typical kind of home service workers who come to your house to do the job, right? You could take photos, you could describe the job, they can ask you questions about it. And then what happens is you have your four or five choices. You have the price, the bid that they're going to charge. You have profiles of the business, ratings and reviews, background checks, a service guarantee from Red Beacon to make sure that we're standing behind the job. And and then you select somebody. When you select somebody, the service provider pays Red Beacon. 10% of the job. Actually, it went up. It was initially 10%. Now it can be 20 or 30%, depending on the type of job. My time is the mirror opposite. My time is actually a site that has jobs where every single service is fixed price. You know exactly what it's going to cost ahead of time. The consumer buys the service from my time. Like, we're actually the merchant of record, but we book the appointment for you, and you know, with the merchant, because we're connected to their calendar. So I'll give you an example. Let's say that after the interview, you decide, that was a really great interview, the best I've ever done, and I'm going to reward myself with a massage. You could go onto MyTime, see who's available in your area right now. You can even filter down by Thai massage or deep tissue or whatever you want, right? See the beautiful profiles, the business, same thing, kind of ratings and reviews, information. But you see the price ahead of time. You see the availability ahead of time. And when you choose a time and price combination, you purchase it, we charge your credit card, it shows up on the merchant's calendar, and they get a notification that you're coming. So it's a little bit different, and it solves a lot of the, I would say, business challenges that I think we faced with Red Beacon as we were growing that business.
All right. I want to hear about those business challenges as we build up. By the way, you said a massage. I'm looking at my hair. I feel like it's a haircut that I need, and I could do that too, right?
You can.
And I book a specific time on my time for the haircut.
Right. You could, there's a couple of things you can do. One is, if you don't have a person you go to today, you could filter down by the day and time and location that you want to go. And you probably would select men's haircut. But you know, there's a lot of different choices. You know, you could do like blowout, no blowout. I mean, there's all kinds of different things you can do. I'm sure you don't color your hair, but if you did, you know, you
I feel like maybe I should start. But if I wanted to, I could pick that out and discreetly set up an appointment with them for a specific time.
Yeah, you're actually... I mean, it's so you can't underestimate the convenience of being able to book and pay for that haircut on my time versus calling the businesses. Half the time they put you on hold or don't answer at all. Finding out who's available, how much they're going to charge, who's good, who's not, all of that's taken care of for you. So it's the experience that we're really trying to model is something like Amazon. It's a retail experience that should be as seamless as that. Now, the second thing I was just to say quickly is, let's say you have somebody you go to. Most people have, you know, they go to the same person every month, right? You add that person to your favorites page, and then the person, the hairstylist, lives there on that favorites page, and there's like a tile, and you click a book button, and it opens up their schedule instantly, like within seconds, and then you choose the time that you want. It's already configured. We know which hairstylist you go to at the salon. We know their price. We know which service you want. So all you have to do is click book, and then the time you want. And then it's done.
And we remind, if they are not on the service already, you guys will do what?
Then what we'll do, so we'll actually call the business and ask, we'll create a free profile for them. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the big learnings I had, is you actually have to build a profile for them, for these local businesses, because they tend not to be as tech savvy as you and me.
Yep.
And so we hire Odesk workers who are specially trained in profile creation and less expensive. And they will create the profile, send it over as a link. Says claim your profile. They click on the profile, everything looks good, they click approve, and then they go live on the site.
Okay.
Go ahead. And so if your business isn't there though, we don't want you to have to wait for that process to happen. So we'll concierge it for you for free. We'll call the hairstylist or the salon and be like, Andrew needs to make an appointment. He said he's expressed a preference for Saturday afternoon. What do you have available? And then we'll let you know. And then we'll confirm it for you. Hopefully that only happens the first time. But you provided us with a warm lead. We're grateful for that. We signed up the salon and the hairstylist, and we throw you a $10 credit for your next booking.
Really?
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. So I kind of joke, like, you can get $10 off any business in America. You should never, ever pay full price again. You can always get $10 off any business that might.
It's like you're creating open table for all the services that I want to use that use dilapidated call answering machines that I have to deal with. I'm obviously getting very carried away with the product here. Usually I talk about the business, and rarely do I get this interested in the product, and that's why I wanted to dive in here. I wonder if the hipster place that I go to that shaves the bottom of my neck here will sign up. I'm going to try it, and we'll let you know.
We'd love to have them on.
So let's see how you got here. I mentioned at the top of the interview that this idea came to you when you were on a trip overseas. You were in Japan. What were you doing there, and how did this idea come to you for the idea that eventually became Red Beacon?
Right. So I had a Japanese friend from business school, and it was the five-year Harvard Business School reunion. So going back, I was a Google product manager at that time, kind of feeling antsy. I'd been at Google for a while. I really loved the experience there, but I was feeling antsy that I wanted to do something entrepreneurial. And I felt like going back to that reunion was actually a good kind of kick in the seat of the pants, because my classmates had done some pretty amazing things. You know, Chris Dixon's in my class, Sal Khan from Khan Academy, just really incredible people. And I sort of felt like I work for a great company and I love my job, but you know, I need to get out there and prove myself, you know, beyond just working for a company. So I started talking to some of my classmates, and this guy from Japan had created a really interesting company. It was a mobile-first application, and it allowed small businesses to summon workers. Let's say that you know you're a restaurant, you need an extra dishwasher, or you're a retailer and you want someone to help you know stock the store, right? All these little things, they would push out the notification to this app, and there's like 100,000 Japanese 20-somethings who had this app on their phone. They would get the push notification, they'd respond, yes, I'm in, I'd like to do this job, and then an hour later they would show up. You know, and Japan is totally different than the US. It's much, much less regulation. There's no like workers' comp, there's no payroll taxes for temporary jobs. It's like you just show up and do the work and it's totally fine. When I went back to see if I could recreate that business in the US, I found out that the heavy bureaucracy and regulation in this country made that almost impossible.
What do you mean? What kind of obstacles were there?
I mean, everything from sexual harassment to workers' comp to, you know, the right to work. You know, in this country, you have the authorization, a work authorization, payroll tax withholding. All of that became our responsibility. It's like we had to be a full-on temp agency.
I see. You like fully this, were this hiring thing. These people. It wasn't this set of freelancers who were just using the app to find work.
Exactly.
And that's a big responsibility.
And I noticed, by the way, that one of our kind of, you know, companies in our space called TaskRabbit a few weeks ago launched TaskRabbit for Business. And sure enough, they're providing all of those services that I didn't want to provide. I didn't want to be a temp agency. And I guess TaskRabbit, given they've raised like $20+ million, could afford to build the infrastructure to do all those things that I felt like were going to be just not worth it.
I was shocked when I saw that too. They even list all the things that they're going to take off your plate, all the regulations that you're talking about that businesses don't want to do. They say that they're going to do it.
Yeah.
So exactly. How far, Ethan, into this idea did you get before you realized this is just not going to work in the US with all the regulations?
Yeah. You know, it was just, I mean, I hadn't left my job at Google. It was probably like 2 or 3 weeks into it as I started to really do the due diligence on this idea that all this stuff came up. But I didn't let go of the idea. I thought, this is still a really interesting idea. I guess I just can't do that exact one. And so it kind of morphed into the idea of, you know, you could be a consumer and need a service provider. You know, you might need a plumber because your hot water heater broke. Or you might need a, you know, a handyman because, you know, something in your house, like a window needs to be replaced. Whatever it is, right? And that's actually where the name Red Beacon came from. I thought of it kind of in my head as, there's an emergency. I'm going to summon help, and I'm going to put up my red beacon like the bat signal, and they're going to come running to take care of my problem, right?
Yep.
And it's all going to be through mobile. As it turns out, we built it on web first, and then we built mobile later. But I kind of, in my head, had always imagined it as a really cool mobile app. And this is back in 2008, so it was a little bit early for mobile, which is why we started on web.
You had a great job at Google. Was it tough to give that up, the salary, the protection, frankly, I walk around San Francisco now and I see the prestige that goes along with working for Google. That couldn't have been easy to shed.
For me, it was. I don't know. I think if you're a real entrepreneur, then you're not looking for those creature comforts. It wasn't like I didn't enjoy the great food. I actually think that Google's food is better than most restaurants you can get in San Francisco. So it is pretty amazing. When I go back to visit friends and have lunch there, I'm like, ooh, this actually was better than I remembered. But that's not really what life is about, right? It's not about, can I live the easiest life? Can I live the one where I'm the most comfortable and do the least amount of work and get the most benefit for it? Like that, I mean, an engineer is like, you know, we like to chew on glass. We like to like create things that everyone says was impossible to create just because we can or because we have the vision to do this thing. And I was, you know, once I had locked onto this vision, I was hungry, and that's all I wanted to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I ended up going a year and a half with no salary and put in $50,000 of my own savings. I wasn't super rich. I mean, I was at Google, but I was there at post-IPO, so it wasn't like I was one of these, you know, multimillionaire early Googlers. So it was real, you know, it was real risk and real pain to kind of do that. But you know, I just lived very leanly, and we kept a lot of equity. I brought on two co-founders from Google as well, so there's three of us. We lived very leanly. We all put in $50,000 into the company to keep it going. We paid ourselves nothing at all, and eventually we decided to enter TechCrunch 50, which was a big decision. At that time, Andrew, TechCrunch 50 was really important. It was in a way that I don't think any of the startup conferences are today, because they've all been diluted and there's so many of them now. But back then it was like, you know, Mint, Yammer. It was like, you know, it was just, it got so much publicity. 1,000 startups from around the world would apply to get in, 1,000. And then, you know, 50 would be selected. So even the selection process was tough. I mean, you had to get through, you had to weed out from 1,000 to 50. And we were so excited when we got the notification from Heather Hardy, who was the CEO of TechCrunch, that we were in. I mean, it was like, oh my God, this has changed our world. We're into TechCrunch 50. You know, and I will tell you that there was not one moment that we thought we were going to win. Not one moment. And even when I was on stage, and they're narrowing it down from 5 people to 4 people to 3 companies to 2 companies, I'm standing there on the stage. In my head, I'm thinking, oh, it's pretty awesome that we're the runners up to TechCrunch 50 when there's 2 left. It wasn't until they said Red Beacon that it even became like, I even realized that it was even possible and we'd won.
Really. I remember when you won. I remember the excitement around it, because I think Mint happened the year before, right?
Right.
So they had a track record of picking intelligently, and all the attention was put on TechCrunch 50 at the time.
It was everything. I mean, we had, to be honest, you know, we haven't gotten into this yet, but the Home Depot acquisition happened because of TechCrunch 50, and I haven't really talked about this.
Really?
It just hasn't really come
Why?
Out.
Why? How does TechCrunch 50 lead to Home Depot even knowing you, let alone acquiring you?
Well, as it turns out, the Home Depot online team was watching TechCrunch 50.
Really?
They were reading TechCrunch, and they said, wow, somebody in the home services space won. Like, this is really interesting to us because, you know, we're this old line retailer from Atlanta, and somebody in the home services is like, you know, has this vision to kind of really be disruptive to the service magics and the yellow pages and everybody else that's been out there before them in a new, much, much more technical way. Like, we're doing algorithmic matching, and you know, we're kind of taking a more googly approach to it than probably some of these companies that were started in the 1990s were. And they came out and they met us, they met me, had breakfast with them over a year and a half before the acquisition even took place. And they were just tracking it closely. I didn't know how serious they were. I mean, I think that, you know, lots of companies talk to you and lots of companies sort of express intentions and want to work together, et cetera. So it wasn't really something that I ever thought about until one day they showed up and they were committed to buying the company.
Wow.
I mean, really committed. It was like they decided that they wanted it. And so we didn't shop it around. There was no process. There was no investment bankers. There was no second bid. It was, if you guys want this, you know, there's probably a price which our VCs and we will accept, which is pretty high, you know, given that we were probably going to raise a Series B. And they got there, and you know, we were excited about their promises of integrating it and really, you know, carrying it through the rest of the country, which is something that was hard to do.
Jason, the co-founder of TechCrunch 50, must be insanely proud to know that this, that the conference not just led to investors contacting you, but eventually a sale. Which also reminds me that Jason invested in a company called Thumbtack. I was having dinner with the founders recently at their house, at their apartment here.
Oh, cool.
And the way that they describe their business sounds just like what you were building. I don't even see much of a difference, except in the way that they get companies on board, in the way that they get customers, companies, and you know, the event, the end user. What do you see there?
Well, I think they are similar. I think Jason would have invested in Red Beacon, but he didn't have the opportunity because we only did one round of $7.5 million, and there was no room for angels. Because remember, we had sort of done the seed round as founders, like there was no outside capital, mm-hmm. And we did the one round of $7.5 million. It didn't make sense for somebody to come in with like $25,000 and get like a hair of the company, right? It, like, why would you do that as an angel? So he went with Thumbtack instead. By the way, Jason's also an investor in MyTime.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, so he's hoping that lightning will strike twice, I guess. But you know, I don't want to speak too much about Thumbtack. I will say that they had a different approach. They had an approach of an open directory, and it was highly SEOable. So it's great in that sense that they get a lot of traffic from SEO. But it wasn't about the you know, I think Red Beacon probably monetized better. you know, because we have this algorithmic matching. We're bringing you 4 bids. We're charging 10% to the service provider initially, and as I said later, you know, 20 or 30%. So we're making money on the transactions. I think Thumbtack was good at, hey, look, we have this really open directory of tons of businesses, a la Craigslist. And you can contact them, and they can contact you, and you can browse categories and things like that. But then I think that they've had to adapt their model over the last year or two because they had this traffic but didn't really have a business. And frankly, now it looks a lot more like RedBeacon, right? It's more lead gen.
Much more. You go to their site, you type in, I need a gardener. They ask you a couple of relevant questions. You hit submit, and then they send it out to gardeners who then bid on your
Exactly. And that's what RedBeacon was. That's not what Thumbtack used to be, but it is what Thumbtack has become.
So what about the issue of getting the chicken and the egg issue with a business like RedBeacon, where you need to get customers, but at the same time, you need to get businesses, and neither one's showing up unless the others are there in large amounts?
Sure. So we did something that we called the Wizard of Oz strategy. Mm-hmm. And we're very public about this, but if the first time you call, you came to RedBeacon and you requested something, let's say you needed a carpenter to build you a fence in your backyard. Okay. We don't have any carpenters. So what happens? Our wizard team calls, goes on to Yelp or goes to the Yellow Pages, looks up highly rated carpenters, starts calling them and says, hey, are you available to do a fence building project on Thursday around 2 p.m.? If so, we'd like you to bid on this. They'd be like, sure. That's what they do for a living. They bid on things.
I see.
That's totally normal for them. Then we'd send them a link to the job. They'd click on it. They'd see the full job. They'd put their bid in. But it wouldn't let them submit their bid until they'd signed up. And so we used a real job that they could get as a carrot to get them to sign up. So that's how we solved the chicken and egg problem. And I'll tell you what, within 2 months, we had 100% of jobs getting bids, and the average was over 4.
How does it spread beyond the people that you guys can contact directly?
Well, we launched city by city, and one of the things that's interesting is how many plumbers do you think need to be on RedBeacon to serve a city the size of San Francisco?
Like good question.
20 maybe?
Right.
It's not like the same plumbers can bid on every job, right? So it's like if you had it, that was the thing that was so startling about RedBeacon is you actually didn't need as many service providers as you think you do. Whereas Thumbtack, to go back to them for a minute, they had, I think, several hundred thousand businesses on it, right? I was like, wow, why do you need that many? It's about the consumer traffic. And it's about how many consumer requests you're getting every day and closing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, my sense with them is they want that many on there because each one of them is another door from Google to their site. And then once they get that person there, the question is, can we get that user to bid on getting even more, to apply to get even more bids? And that's how we get that user locked in.
Right. Right. But I it depends on what your business model is. I mean, the RedBeacon model was a consumer requests something and we want them to choose somebody. For that to work, what you need is, we did data analysis. More than 4 bids did nothing. Like you weren't more likely to close the job if you brought in 10 versus 4. And so if you brought them 4 super high quality businesses that were priced competitively, that were highly rated and reviewed, and it would do good work when they went, then you only need 4 businesses. And so what we learned is that we need to get 20% of our businesses to win 80% of the jobs. Why? Because they really gave a crap about RedBeacon. They showed up on time. They never flaked. They did good work. They never cheated. They had good prices because they were getting a lot of jobs. They were making tens of thousands of dollars by using RedBeacon, and they didn't want to shoot that goose, right, that lays the golden egg. Whereas if we brought somebody brand new on, okay, now there's a whole training and handholding process. The quality could be variable. We don't know yet. It hasn't built up a reputation. It's not that we don't want new businesses, but I'm saying the goal was not to bring as many new businesses as we could.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
And by the way, everything that I just talked about, Thumbtack, I think it's public, but basically I got it from a competitor of theirs over drinks. I didn't hear it directly from them. Otherwise, I wouldn't be revealing it. And they will be doing an interview here so we can find out more about them. All right. So now you've got a strategy for bringing service providers on board. How are you getting the traffic, the people who will eventually be buying from these service providers?
Right. So that was challenging. With RedBeacon, it was a lot of AdWords and Facebook ads and other things like that. Mm-hmm. That was a huge tranche of the traffic, which was expensive. And I'll be totally honest. you know, while I was there, it was we never figured out how to make that ROI positive. I mean, we could bring traffic there and we could get revenue, but it was actually less revenue than we were paying for that traffic. So that was tough. So then we started looking at distribution partnerships. You know, we did distribution partnerships with a number of companies, including Yahoo, where it's actually built into Yahoo search, would be the top search results, and it was algorithmically put in there. So, you know, there was NBC, ABC, Fox, and they had widgets on their websites, SF Gate. I mean, we did so many different, you know, these distribution type of deals, right? We tried social. That was difficult. I mean, frankly, one of the things that is so great about Home Depot buying the company is there's 100,000 plus people coming every week into a Home Depot store in America. You know, and so all those people are getting exposed to Red Beacon at a time that they're very interested in some kind of home service thing, right?
When you did the distribution deals, though, did you had to pay up front, right?
No, 100% of them, they were all pay for performance. They were
really?
Rep shares. Yeah, even the Yahoo one, which is pretty amazing, was all was rep share.
With guarantees?
There was no guarantees.
Who's your biz dev person?
Me.
You were the one who worked out the deal with Yahoo, where there's no guarantee, just share of revenue. Wow.
It brought them onto a co-branded Yahoo Red Beacon page, which is basically the Red Beacon page with a logo that was co-branded. And yeah, it was just a 50% rep share.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is impressive. Now, I'm looking at your background. I don't see biz dev experience in your background.
Well, what entrepreneur is not naturally a salesperson, business development person, right? At its heart, being an entrepreneur, you never stop selling. You're selling investors on the dream. You're selling employees on the dream. You're selling partnerships. You know, you're selling the media and the press. You're selling customers. It's like you're always, you know, selling something. And so if you don't have that built into you innately, then you better have a co-founder who does, right?
I see. Yeah. And right. And you were the guy out of the three of you. You were all three engineers, weren't you?
No, I have an MBA from Harvard and you know, a non-technical undergrad, economics and public policy studies from Duke.
I see.
My two co-founders were both CS. You know, one was from MIT and one was from Princeton and Cambridge. So they were very, very technical, more so than me. I was a product manager at Google, so I did have a, you know, a real passion for the product and a good product sense, but you know, not in terms of actually coding it up. No.
All right. So you've got a way of bringing people in the door. And you've got a way of bringing service providers in. Then I guess we hit on the issue that you and I talked about before we started this interview, which is you work hard to bring a customer in the door, and they may not think of you again till they haven't, maybe not even ever. In fact, can you talk about that?
Yeah, so I will. So one of the things that probably is obvious in hindsight, and I think a few people did warn us about this, is that people don't need home services that often. I mean, how often are you, like, you know, remodeling your home, you know, and how often do you not have somebody already? It's not that people don't need a handyman, you know, on a regular basis, but they already have somebody. And what Red Beacon was good at was bringing you new people, right? We're bringing you bids from four different people each time that you use it. And so that contributed to a lower lifetime value of a customer. Because, you know, what is the definition of LTV but how much you monetize times how many times, you know, you have a sale each year, right? Times the life of that customer, maybe plus some sort of referral, like if they're referring some other people and there's some virality, right? I mean, that's basically what LTV is. And so Red Beacon was tough because there was almost no referrals despite our best efforts. And I think that's because people might want to, they probably don't even want to talk about the plumber. Like, who wants to talk about that, right? But even if they did, they probably want to talk about the plumber to their friends, not about Red Beacon. They're like, I have a great plumber for you. Oh yeah, he's fantastic. You know,
right.
Let me give you. That's what would happen. And so I'd be like, no, tell them about Red Beacon too, right? And but that, it wasn't something that people felt like they wanted to go tell everybody about. So virality was pretty low. And then the people didn't need the Red Beacon service all that often. So if 6 months or 9 months goes by, you may very well have forgotten about it. Probably because you Googled it and clicked on an AdWord, and maybe it didn't even really register too much that you're using Red Beacon. It wasn't like a destination, right?
Right.
Angie's List, who's in our space, has been building up a brand for, you know, 10 years and spending tens of millions of dollars a year on advertising, on radio and television. So they have done an admirable job of creating a brand, right? And so that's really, you know, so people probably do think of Angie's List when they think of home services, but RedBeacon hadn't been around long enough, nor did we have the money to invest in building a brand like Angie's List.
They also, Angie's List locks people into a membership. So you feel like this membership gave you the value of, right?
Review. I mean, it's basically Yelp. It's like, you know, user generated content, ratings and reviews.
What about, yeah. Isn't there a membership there?
There is.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's a member, it's a ratings and reviews behind a walled garden paywall. I mean, you can't crawl it, you can't access it, you have to be a member. So they get no SEO value, of course, because it's locked.
Right.
I don't know. In the world of Yelp, it's hard for me to understand how Angie's List survives. But, you know, I know that subscription model is gold because people get lazy and inertia carries them through and it renews and they just kind of stick with it.
The subscription model also seems to help because all I see when I go to CNN over here is commercials for buy gold. The world is ending. Buy gold. Or Angie's List, and then it's regular people talking about how they're on Angie's List together and giving each other recommendations. And I guess because they charge all this money, they could afford to bombard the airways with commercials.
Yeah, exactly. I looked at their 10K. It looks like about half of the revenue is coming from advertising from the businesses to be on top of the search results.
I see.
And half is coming from like, you know, or maybe less than half is coming from the membership. Yeah.
The other thing that you told April in the pre-interview is that you guys hired an offshore call center to badger your customers to select a service provider. To remind them, I think badger is her word. What happened there?
Yeah. So one of the other things that we had learned, you know, as we were trying to figure out how to get the, you know, make the company profitable, is the drop-off rate was substantial when somebody put in a request for the service. And the time to come back to RedBeacon to look at your bids. Substantial drop-off rate. I mean, much more than half. And, you know, we'd email them. We'd even text message them, and it didn't seem to be enough. So then we got this crazy idea of, why don't we have, you know, people call you and be like, hey, we have these bids for you. Like, what happened with your job? Like, do you still need this person? Like, you know, let me tell you about who came back with bids and how great they are, and would you like to select one of them?
And did that work?
Because yeah, it did. It probably increased the conversion rate, you know, upwards of 30% from where it used to be, but it didn't work enough to the point where like the company was profitable yet.
I see.
So a lot of these learnings from RedBeacon, I think, colored my views and the business that I wanted to create with my time. You know, whereas a lot of those problems of, do I, you know, I don't need to ever come back because I don't get home services that often. I'm not going to rebook the same person because I have a direct relationship with them now, so you're cut out for the future. And you know, the experience of having to come back to get your just to get your bids that kind of drop off, all of those problems have gone away with my time because we've signed up the businesses ahead of time. The calendars are connected, so you complete your transaction in that one session. The prices are there ahead of time, right? So you know already what it's going to cost. And if you see somebody you like, you click on it, and it goes into a shopping cart, and you purchase it, and it's booked. And here's, this is really important, we want you to come back to my time when you rebook them. We don't want you to call them directly. So we don't charge the businesses for the repeat bookings. So, because otherwise the business would tell their customers not to use my time again, right? They'd be like, great, thanks, please never use that again. I don't want to pay the commission.
Right.
So they don't get charged for the repeat bookings. And it goes into a favorites page where all of your businesses are on one single page, and you manage everything there. You know, the rebookings, the reminders to rebook, cancellations, all of that happens right on your favorites page. And at some point, we'll make that a public page for you so that your friends can come and see all the businesses that you go to. So I'm in the market right now for a house cleaner. If you live in San Francisco, I would be really interested to see who you're using, because if you've been using them and they're on your favorites page, I wouldn't mind booking them.
I get that. I would feel that way too. Right now, I'm looking at your hair and my hair, and I'm saying, that's what I'm going for with my hair. This hipster place that I'm going to needs to do that. I would definitely go to your place.
Need to get them on.
Yes. Totally. Who did you talk to before launching My Time to make sure that the product made sense for people other than you?
Right. I think everybody who has ever used OpenTable, everybody who has ever used Kayak or Expedia to book a flight, I think everybody who's ever used Uber to get a car, they understand the value of pulling out your phone or going to the computer and booking something online when you want to do it. Everyone knows how frustrating it is to call a business, be put on hold, get no answer, have them call you back while you're in the middle of a meeting when they finally get back to you. It's so annoying. It's like, it drives me crazy. I'm too busy for this. And I get no pleasure in talking to the secretary. Like, it's not something I look forward to at all. And oftentimes, frankly, I do things late at night. You know, I'm a hard worker. I get home late, and it's like there's some things I need to get done. So I go online and I do them then. So I like, in this world that we live in today, when work and play and vacations and non-vacations and travel and everything gets blended together in a way that probably didn't, 20 years ago with our parents' generation. You need things like this.
But did you, do any
things in your schedule?
But I kind of feel like a lot of what we use, I imagine that the rest of the world is going to use, and then I get disappointed when they don't. Like when Zarly came out and they were going to do grocery shopping in Washington, D.C., where I happened to live at the time, I thought, this is going to take off like crazy because who wants to go grocery shopping? I'm busy. I'm working all day long. I just want to use the computer. I don't want to wait in line at the long Trader Joe's, et cetera. That didn't work out for them because I guess there weren't a lot of people like me who were maniacs who wanted to work all day and then go home and forget about doing anything. So how do you did you even need to test it, or were you feeling so sure that you were just on the right track and you were going to launch it anyway?
It's interesting. Something like grocery shopping, I don't have a good intuition for because I don't necessarily even know what I want. It's usually more of like I'm walking up and down the aisle and I'm like, oh yeah, that looks good. I'm going to grab one of those. Or I want to look at the fruit or the vegetables and make sure that it's fresh. I mean,
makes total sense. I never would have imagined that anyone feels that way. When I think about it, yeah, I guess there are people. For me, it's same stuff.
When I go back to a Zip Zap salon in the Lower Haight to get my hair cut, I've been going to the same guy for 11 years. I know exactly what the haircut's going to be. I know what it's going to cost. There's no variability there. I mean, he might have an off day, but whether I call him or book him online is not going to affect that.
Right.
If I need a massage and I'm looking for a deep tissue massage or a Thai massage or something, and I'm like do a quick scan to see who's available, it doesn't have the same kind of variability, I think, as grocery shopping. I'm more like I have a better sense of what it's going to be. By the way, not every business works for my time. Almost none of the Red Beacon businesses work. Like, we're not going to probably ever have plumbers, electricians, roofers, things like that, because they're not fixed price and they're not fixed duration appointments.
I see.
I don't think restaurants will work. How do we know what you're going to eat when you get there? Not to mention this open table that dominates the space.
Right.
But even if they did, I don't think it's a good fit.
Okay. So what about checking your to make sure, validating your idea with the service providers? Did you take it out to them and see if they'd be interested in it or if they're still
they loved the idea.
How did you do it? What was your process?
I knew that I understood one of the big pain points of service providers from my Red Beacon experience is open appointments in their day. It's weird. It's not like, Apple is like, God, we'd love to have another, half a million customers this month buying an iPhone. That would be awesome. It's not like that for a business, a local business. It's my day is got a 3-hour block here where I'm not working, and that's really annoying because then customers are going to come in again. I'd love to fill those three hours with somebody so I'm not just sitting there idle and making no money, right?
Yeah.
And so my time is phenomenal in that regard, and then we say, let us be a retailer for you. Let us distribute those open appointment times to new and existing customers who could fill those times that are open. And if you're already booked, we won't show those because we're synchronized with your calendar. And we went even further. We said, we're going to dynamically price, aka discount, your hard to fill time slots. We're going to do what United does, in the worst possible flight that nobody wants to take, and that one's way cheaper than the popular flights. It could be half the price, right? Maybe even less. We're going to do the same thing for you, and it's worth it because you don't want to sit there idle. You want the chance to get a new customer, and you want to be working and making some money during that time slot.
But was there a way of validating your assumptions? Because it seems like there's some inherent assumptions in here, and it's okay if there aren't, if there's no validation. I don't want it to just be an egghead interview where you feed me this lean startup process because that's what we're supposed to do. But I'm sensing that maybe the service providers don't even want to use the internet, don't want you to sync with their calendar, don't trust calendars online because they have the paper calendars. Maybe they like the idea of making money when they're not working, but they hate the idea of discounting their stuff ever because then it sets the wrong message. I don't know what kind of bug could be in their minds. Were you validating it with them, or did you just say, I've been in this space long enough, I know what to produce. If I create it, they will follow me there?
I felt I didn't do too much validation other than having talked to a lot of people just through the last several years in the local space that I was in. I didn't do separate research for this. But I will say this. There are some of those businesses like you, people in the businesses like you described. These are people who don't do email. They don't have a computer in their office. They don't check their cell phone during the day. And they're not good fits for us. And they probably won't be on my time for a while, at least until, you know, their children take over the business or something.
Right.
But I will say this. The trend is in our favor. These businesses now, most of them have Facebook pages. Most of them have websites. Almost all of them have email. Most of them have cell phones. And they use apps, right? So the trends are in our favor. And by the way, you don't have to discount. That's an option. As we call it dynamic pricing. You can flip that on or off. It's kind of like a happy hour. That's how they understand it. It's like right. my happy hour time. And they like it.
As a user, I could see the value of it. If I was going to go get a haircut in 2 days, but I see that some barber is free later today and would give me a little bit of a discount if I do it, I'd hustle over.
Totally.
How
yeah,
did you
like it?
When you and April talked, you said that you launched with 1,500 businesses. How do you launch with that many businesses on a new platform?
We started signing up businesses even before the product was done back in August mm-hmm. of last year, so almost a year ago. We started the sales process. And I'll tell you what, Andrew, I didn't know how to build an efficient sales team because at Red Beacon we didn't have to. Remember I was telling you that you know you could have like 15 or 20 plumbers and they could serve the whole city? Yeah, you can be inefficient if that's all you have to acquire.
Right.
Right? I mean, you and I could do that in like 2 afternoons. The My Time sales team is like a well-oiled machine. We brought in a sales director from Trulia. We hooked up Salesforce. We've got monitors on the wall. The salespeople know they have to make a certain number of calls every day. We know the average number of decision makers reached. We know the number of decision makers converted. They're commissioned and comped based on that. And I mean, it is, you know, it's a real sales organization. Now, it's not big. It's not like we have hundreds and hundreds of people yet. But it is, it's built, it operates like a big company.
I see.
In terms of the sales team.
So how'd you learn how to do that?
I had to learn. I mean, everything, all this stuff is out there in this day and age. I mean, you talk to experts. Our sales director had some experience in it. I asked other people like Paige Craig from BetterWorks, how did you do it? And I talked to his guy and I went over to Zozy and I talked to their sales director and said, what do you guys do? It's like anything else. If you don't know it, you make it your business to learn it. And I realized that with my time, I had to make it my business to learn how to do a sales, to build a sales organization and a sales team. And we have really great people now. Like they really know what they're doing and the merchants love them. Like, because sometimes I'll go get a My Time service, right? And they'll be like, oh, do you know Graham or do you know Becca? Oh God, he's great. Oh, she's great, I love her. You know, and like they know them by name. It's like, it's great. It's really cool.
And apparently they know you by name too. Apparently someone called up for My Time, called up a service provider who said, hey, is this Ethan Anderson startup?
Yeah, he said, I forget how much he made. He made something like $45,000 or $50,000 in Red Beacon. He said, if you're starting this company, I want to be on it. He was a handyman, actually.
It's great to have a good reputation. There's a note here that I wasn't sure, and I probably should have asked April about it, but we're here, so I'll bring it up directly to you.
Here.
You said something about the Google video story, making sure all pieces of the product are consistent. Do you know what that refers to?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about the Google video story. If I had some free time, I would like to write a book about the Google video story.
I would love
Why
to read that.
Why did Google video?
Yes.
Google is a very powerful organization today, don't get me wrong. But this was like the height. I mean, this is when Google was the hottest company in the universe, right? Google video lost to YouTube. It was unheard of. How could Google, with all of its resources, you know, the best engineers in the world, all the press, darlings, everything, how did they lose to YouTube? And my conclusion is that Google Video tried to be everything to everybody, and the pieces didn't go together at all. And in fact, the pieces of Google Video were diametrically opposed to one another. Google Video was trying to serve premium content providers like CBS, NBA Basketball, and Charlie Rose. And what do these people want? Well, they want the things that iTunes content providers want. They want DRM protection. They want a store where you have to purchase things. They certainly don't want to be next to pornographic or, you know, other copyrighted infringing material that users uploaded, right? You know, we couldn't really advertise in Google Video because there was like a lot of infringing content that could be uploaded because we had the UGC or user-generated content portion of it there as well,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, let's flip to the other side. If you're YouTube, what do you want to provide to your users? Well, you want a super easy way to upload content. So they built an HTML uploader, which was awesome. You just click the file, you hit submit, and the file just, and it just shows up. There was no screening at YouTube. Google Video screened every single video, thousands of videos. There was a long delay. It could take you 3 days or something for your video to go live. YouTube would be live within minutes. YouTube built all these social features. Social features today are taken for granted, trust me. 2008, they were not taken for granted yet. Ratings and reviews, embeddable widgets for people embedded on their MySpace profiles, which got them lots of distribution, commenting, playlists, you know, all those things. YouTube came up with these things, and it went, and of course, you and I know, and everybody knows that there was tons of infringing content. I mean, it's like, right? Of course, they would take it down if somebody submitted a DMCA request, but I mean, it was all there. And that's how YouTube grew like lightning. Well, Google Video is basically in conflict with itself at all times.
Because Google Video is trying to make Charlie Rose happy, who does not want to embed his videos. He wants to sell his videos. And trying to make Andrew happy, who does want to embed his videos and wants everyone to spread his videos. And those two people can't be serviced by the same product in the early stages of a company at the same time. And that's the challenge.
Exactly.
And you were in there. As a guy in there, did you notice that this was happening? Was it painful for you?
Yeah, it was very difficult. I mean, I think we were watching YouTube and trying to chase the hottest thing. So, you know, they would come out with something, and then, you know, 4 months later, it'd be like, we have to have comments.
Do you remember something like that? What was it, like comments?
Yeah. You know, I was actually, I mean, not to absolve myself in any way, but I was actually the international product manager.
Mm-hmm.
It was my first job at Google, and I had a number of roles that they offered to me. And I took this job to internationalize and launch Google Video in other countries. So I was actually spending a lot of my time in Europe and Asia launching the product internationally, translating it, dealing with copyright and privacy things there, getting content providers to get on board, marketing it. You know, so I wasn't as, I guess, as influential, as you might say, on the core product development. It was out of my hands a little bit. But I saw this, and I was concerned about it. And I think everybody saw it, right? But what was happening is video is a marketplace as much as eBay is a marketplace. And at some point, what, you know, in technical terms, the corpus of video content was so overwhelmingly large at YouTube that it was getting to the point where nobody could catch it anymore.
Yeah.
Even if we did all the right things from that point on and we were perfect and we never made another bad decision, it was too late. Everybody was uploading their videos there, and everybody was going there to watch the videos, and they had just won the game, and there was no catching it.
And do you doubt
yourself? By the way, it's not like, I'll say something interesting. In my opinion, it's not like Facebook. Facebook could still lose in the sense that everyone could decide there's a new hotness in town and they're going to move their social network over there. YouTube can't really lose. You know, there are billions of hours of content on YouTube servers right now. They have an incredible infrastructure for serving it and hosting it. It's fast. It's cached all over the world. I mean, it's just, it's almost at this point impossible to recreate. I think YouTube will be here for the rest of our lives.
Yeah. It is a very defensible business. Internally, yeah. Though, I've been looking at some messages from my audience, entrepreneurs who are wrestling with inner doubt. And when I ask them why, they often will say, I had this one big failure, or this failure at a company that I worked for that I was marginally associated with. It makes me feel like I'm very vulnerable, like I'm going to fail, or I'm made to be, or I'm a failure. Why didn't this make you feel that way? Why didn't you say, hey, you know what? I was with all of Google's power, with all of Google's strength. I competed against this upstart and I lost. Maybe I just don't have what it takes. I better not risk it on myself.
I don't think in general, I don't have that kind of mentality. Like, you know, first of all, I didn't really internalize all the failure of Google Video on myself, right?
Okay.
Because Google's a massive organization, and, you know, I was my first job as a PM at Google, internationalizing the product. So I don't think that I learned a ton. And I was I crushed? Yes. You know, I couldn't go, like, Hunter Walk, you know Hunter, right?
A little.
Or you know of Hunter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was also a PM on Google Video. He was able to, you know, brush it off and go over to YouTube. He went to work at YouTube, and he spent the rest of his career at Google there. He did really well. He became director of product management, and for some time, he was leading the product at YouTube. You know, I actually couldn't do that. I felt like I had been punched in the gut that Google had bought YouTube for $1.65 billion, this company that I thought about for the last year, working 7 days a week to try to beat them, to suddenly be like, hey guys, what's up? I'm going to come help you guys now, you know, build your company. It was like, I couldn't even do it. I was like, let me work on something else. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not that it didn't affect me. I don't know that I blamed myself for the entire failure of Google Video, but it definitely affected me, and it hurt a lot.
And you're the kind of person who can you brush it off too, like Hunter? Can you?
Well,
how do you disconnect yourself?
I couldn't do it right away. I mean, Hunter was able to basically be like, you know, the queen is dead, long live the queen. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
I mean, I couldn't do it. So, I mean, now it's fine. It's been years,
yep.
Right? But I wasn't like, I couldn't go the next week and be like, let me go help YouTube succeed now.
So how do you do that? The strength that, I want to end this interview with this, with the strength of mind. I don't want to understate it. The ability to not internalize setbacks, to not take other people's setbacks and make them your own and then define yourself by it it's a huge strength. A lot of people don't have it. How do you do it?
Cognitive dissonance.
Doing what?
I think
cognitive dissonance.
I mean, I think entrepreneurs have cognitive dissonance. I think that they see the world through their own lens and they rationalize things in weird ways that allows them to keep going forward where other people would be, you know, emotional, or it would stop them, or would cause them to be uncertain, or feel like they're riddled with indecision or self-doubt. I think entrepreneurs just, you know, it's like you just don't even think about it. We're probably horrible people in a relationship, because, you know, what makes a successful relationship with somebody is probably that you reflect and you think about the failures and you kind of, you know, you work them out. I think entrepreneurs are like bulls. They're like, I'm not going to even think about it. I'm like on to the next thing, right?
Yep.
Let me just forget about it and move forward, which obviously is terrible for a relationship. You probably accumulate baggage over time that causes it to fail. So I'm sure if there was a study, entrepreneurs must have a higher divorce rate, and it has to be.
I can imagine. Do you ever see the 60 Minutes piece with Arnold Schwarzenegger after he wrote his book?
Yes.
About what, do you see, he's got it like you wouldn't believe. He can say, yes, I slept with the maid, I had a baby.
He's just like, yeah. He's like, yeah, I cheated on her, and I didn't tell her, and just kept going. I pretended it wasn't happening.
It's nothing to emulate, but it's an exaggeration that that shows how that process works. Just move on.
I remember the 60 Minutes interviewer was just aghast. I think she could barely contain herself.
We all were. And he knew he was doing it in front of a national audience, a huge audience, but that's who he is. He can just move on. All right. The important thing here for us is congratulations on Red Beacon, number one, and congratulations to us on My Time, because all of us who are really busy people who use services that will go and get our grocery and we'll try to shave a minute here, a minute there, because our time is valuable, now have an opportunity to stop going to Yelp and then calling up those companies that we need a haircut from, like me, or need a massage for our girlfriends or wives or husbands. Just go to a website and just book it online. We do it now with restaurants through OpenTable. We can now do the same thing with everyone else on My Time. And you've got a great domain. MyTime.com/favorites is where you guys will be my valet. You will go call up these people for me.
I'm looking for your hipster hair salon.
Oh, I got to do it. You mentioned it in here. Now I've got to go back into the transcript and get the name, because I was focused on the interview and didn't write it down. But I appreciate you doing the interview and building the site.
Great. Thanks, Andrew. It's great to be here.
Thank you all for being a part of it.